Broadcasting from Nashville, Tennessee, this is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insights into today's church and culture.
I'm here today with my colleague Scott McConnell. Scott done an interview with Jarrett Pingleton, who we've done some research with in the past. Tell us a little bit about what you guys talked about and some exciting things he's got coming out.
We have done a couple different research projects with Jared, and in both of those, they both revealed that the church has a long ways to go in helping people with mental illness. And one of the fun things in this particular interview is Jared provides a number of resources that are really helpful in a church thinking through how they can be more helpful. And so we really want research to be practical. And if someone kind of leaves our research going, now how do I start something? Jared's got some excellent ways to get started in this segment.
I'm joined today by Dr. Jared Pingleton, who is Vice President of Professional Development at the American Association of Christian Counselors. Jared, thank you so much for joining us today.
My delight, Scott. It's good to be with you.
And it's been really informative for me through the years, as we've had a couple different opportunities to do some surveys related to mental illness, related to suicide, and really how those topics interact with the church, and finding that honestly, churchgoers are wanting the church to be involved.
We
saw about 3 years ago that family members of those who have some of the more severe mental illnesses, more than 8 out of 10 really felt like the church has a responsibility to provide resources, not just compassion, but to provide resources and support for individuals with mental illness. And on the recent survey that we did together, again, more than 8 out of 10 churchgoers, not just those in the families of someone with mental illness, but churchgoers, said that churches have a responsibility to step up. And appreciate you joining us today, as obviously American Association of Christian Counselors is addressing this on a regular basis with some of their professional community, but also equipping churches. I don't know if everybody knows that you have resources to equip church leaders. And one of those that I'd like to ask you a number of questions about today is the new book that you and Dr. Tim Clinton wrote, The Struggle is Real, How to Care for Mental and Relational Health Needs in the Church. By way of introduction, the struggle that it refers to, I've got to read this list here in the introduction that just kind of illustrates how the kind of struggles we're talking about with mental illness really have taken over many people's lives. It lists out divorce, suicide, childhood sexual abuse, depression, pornography, anxiety and panic disorders, cohabitation, bipolar disorders, alcoholism, domestic violence, abortion, drug and prescription medication abuse, adultery, gambling, single-parent families, trauma, grief, eating disorders. That's a long list, but it's almost like who hasn't been affected by some of those things? Talk a little bit, Jared, just about the struggle and how close it is to churches today.
Well, you're absolutely right. The struggle is real, and I point out in the book that these struggles find their way home to everyone's home. When you look at the numbers for the different issues and challenges you just identified, they're staggering. 20 to 25% of adults in the U.S. suffer at any present time with a diagnosable mental illness, 50% in their lifetime, 14 to 20% of children. 20 to 25% of the population meets criteria for alcohol use disorder. The pornography epidemic is exponential. Research suggests 60 to 80% of men, 40% or more of women, use pornography on a regular basis. 25% of women and men have had at least one abortion. The opioid, of course, addiction epidemic is unprecedented in history in terms of how many people are being impacted by that. 48% of all live births in the U.S. a couple of years ago were to unwed parents. We see then on the other extreme, one out of six couples are infertile. 2,000 children per day are abused in the United States. It goes on and on and on. The numbers are staggering. And then in suicide, we see 117 people ending their lives every day in the United States.
Wow. In the most recent study that we did together, and was also co-sponsored by Liberty University, we found that suicide is something that pastors are very aware of. More than two-thirds of them have seen a suicide in their local community. A third of churchgoers have had somebody close to them take their own life. We've talked a bit, that's probably one of the more obvious situations where, when somebody's at risk, that we want to be turning to an expert. And I was really intrigued. It was actually a chapter in the book that you wrote on referrals. And we've asked pastors, and the numbers are still not as high as we would like them to be for churches having a referral list ready of who they would turn to. First of all, let me ask a real practical question. If a leader is listening today and they don't have somebody to refer people to for mental health or even suicide potential, how would they create such a list?
Sure. Great question, Scott. There are some Christian organizations that have lists already created that are vetted. Excuse me, the one that we have is on our website, aacc.net, and you can find a counselor there. And we make it very difficult, basically, for a professional to get on our list, both Christianly and clinically. We vet them stringently. I know Focus on the Family does as well. There are other organizations that do that. So that would be an easy step. But what I think is a better referral, as I unpack in the book, is to make a warm referral that's personal. And so to that pastor or church leader that's listening, I really want to encourage you to think of developing relationships with healthy, mature, godly people in your community that are trained as mental health professionals, and view them as an extension of your ministry. And you will need to develop a relationship with them, get to know them, take them out to lunch or dinner or breakfast, and find out who they are and what they're about, what their own personal character and life is about, and then can say with confidence that you can refer one of your sheep to this person in a safe and healthy way.
I noticed something I underlined in that chapter was something you said. While it is a fact of psychology that everyone can help someone, it is a reality of ecclesiology that no one possesses all the gifts and therefore can help everyone. And I think, as ministry leaders, we want to help everyone, and we want to be so welcoming, and our language even talks that way, that we want to be welcoming everyone and inviting everyone, obviously, to the spiritual hope that we're sharing. But talk a little more. I was intrigued that the chapter is entitled "The Art of Making an Effective Referral," and I think that's probably what you were starting to hint at there with the relationship with the person you're going to refer them to. But talk a little more about what is it that makes it an art rather than just something practical or even a science of referring, who to refer them to.
That's a great question, Scott. As you know, I'm a clinical psychologist, but I'm also a third-generation minister. And so I'm keenly aware in my ministry colleagues' training that they're taught that implicitly and almost subtly that we should be able to help everyone. And that's just not realistic. If we understand the gifting dynamics of the body of Christ, we realize that each of us are gifted differently, and thus we need one another. And so I think it really is an extension of that principle. And I think part of the art has to do with handing off that person well and warmly to where they don't feel rejected or abandoned, that we follow up with our parishioner throughout the process of getting them help to someone else. And for me, that is, I think, a great referral. When I can say with integrity that I know of a colleague that I trust who is more experienced or better trained in a certain area than me, or is specialized in a certain area that I could perhaps do an adequate job but not an expert job, I will say to that person, I'm delighted to refer you to Dr. Smith or Dr. Jones, who can help you more effectively than me. And so I think sometimes as pastors, we feel like, oh, that activates our feelings of inferiority or inadequacy if we say, ah, I really think so-and-so could help you better than I. But the truth is, it's true. None of us have the time and training and talent to help everyone.
One of the things when I opened the book, I was surprised at was that each of the chapters is a how-to chapter, and so an incredibly practical
right.
book. But
right.
really, the suggestion is there for creating a lot of different types of ministries, mm-hmm. mental health. Effective self-care, effective referrals, lay counseling ministries that pastors have told us that possibly as many a little over one out of five churches may have some kind of lay counseling in place. But even ministries for autistic and special needs children, adoptive and foster parents. So really, you know, 25 chapters of a lot of different ministries. Talk a little bit about the journey from 3 years ago when it felt like we were doing good to get people to talk about mental illness at all, to now
yes.
talking about, you know, can a church actually be taking a step toward starting ministries for some of the specific need areas?
Well, it's an exciting journey, Scott, as you know, and have been a part of that, and your research has really validated and verified the need for it. The research previously has forever shown that typically the first person that an individual or couple or family turns to when they're hurting is to their pastor, priest, or rabbi. That has always been the case in America. And so we need to acknowledge that and support that. And then beyond that, I think moving and mobilizing pastoral leaders to finding the best ways to help their flock is really the impetus for our book. We wanted it to be, as you said, a very practical how-to manual, a toolbox, if you will, to how to help pastors do the work of ministry more effectively. I know that as important as homiletics and hermeneutics and exegetics is to pastoral ministry and to pastoral training, those are important. But the truth is, most seminary and Bible school programs don't do as good a job helping pastors Monday through Friday with the work of ministry and dealing with people. And so what we decided to do was to try to step into that content gap and fill that with a toolbox, a very practical how-to manual of making sure that being able to reach and help hurting people can be a key component of pastoral ministry.
As I look at the list, are there a couple of these that you find are still overlooked, that it's pretty rare that a church is working in one of these ministry spaces?
Sure. As you said, there's 25 different facets that we identified there, and some of them numerically, particularly for smaller to intermediate churches, may not be as big, but I think... certainly, childhood sexual trauma is one of the most overlooked areas. That one out of three women in the church on Sunday morning, one out of four to five men have been sexually abused as a child. And the impact and implications of that are enormous for ministry. I think another area that flies under the radar, so to speak, is alcoholism. I see it as absolutely rampant. Opioid addiction is finally starting to get some press. But what flies under the radar in our culture is that 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 5 people that sit in the pew on Sunday morning meet criteria for alcohol use disorder, and nobody talks about it. And we must. It affects and impacts the family and the marriages and individual health enormously. And many pastors are unaware of that reality. And I think in general, the issue of other mental health kinds of issues are huge, because then some of the symptoms like family breakup, sexual addiction, et cetera, those things are ways to medicate the pain that people are not having healed and helped. And we want to help with that.
It really seemed like you and Dr. Clinton kind of modeled some of what you're talking about, in that you didn't try to be experts in all 25 areas. You had other experts speak to each of them and write those chapters, which I thought really modeled what you're talking about here. Obviously a church leader can use this as a reference tool if they already know, hey, I'd like to start this ministry. The chapter on that topic obviously is going to help them get going. But if a pastor or a church leader picks this up and is just thinking about, hey, I want to help with some of these real struggles, should they be thinking, hey, I need to be doing, or our church needs to be doing all 25 of these? Or how should they be thinking through where to start and what ministries they should be helping with?
Well, you raise an interesting implication, and that is it can feel overwhelming when we start to sort of pull the covers back and take a look at the pain and the suffering of humanity. But that's, to me, what's encouraging, Scott. That's what the church is for. We are to be the light and the salt. And I think an effective church should be a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints. And so I would say to that pastor or church leader or elder or deacon, hey, 3 ministries are better than 2, and 7 are better than 4. So whatever you can build out and do to reach hurting people in your congregation and community, I think is great. And to me, that's a win. I think, I look back on the way I was trained pastorally, and Ephesians 4 was kind of lacking. We were sort of trained that the pastor implicitly should do everything. And of course, no pastor can. What Paul is teaching the church at Ephesus is that the role of pastoral leadership is to train God's people for works of service or ministry. And so that's really an extension of our heart here too, is pastors, you don't have to do it all, and you can't anyway, but the goal is to disciple people, to disciple people, to disciple people.
And at first glance, 2 of the chapters kind of felt like they didn't fit to me, because they didn't, on their surface, look like they were talking about struggles. And that was the 2 chapters that talked about mentoring, mentoring men, mentoring women. Talk a little bit about how that fits into possibly how a church leader can be thinking about helping with these real life struggles.
Sure. That's a great issue, Scott. And I personally think those are 2 of the best chapters in the book. I think either one of those is worth the price of the book, because Drs. Roy Smith and Joniel Kirby, respectively, have outstanding ministries they have developed for women and men. And so what they do is they share in those chapters not only how to do that, but why we need to have that done in terms of the enormous needs for Titus 2:4, for example, for women being applied in the church, to the necessity of that, the power of that, the opportunities and benefits of that are just amazing, in terms of not just impacting that woman, but that woman and her husband and her family and her relationships with other women in the church. I think if a healthy church has a viable men's and women's ministry, they will experience exponential growth numerically, spiritually, and relationally. I really think those are vital kinds of things, not just a monthly breakfast or, some get together once every however often, but really where there's a discipleship intentionality to speak into one another's lives as a lay person, where older women are nurturing younger women, older men are helping younger men navigate through life successfully That's invaluable. That is a precious and priceless component of a healthy functioning church.
As I look back at the research from a couple of years ago, it was a small number, but still 1 out of 5 pastors really seemed to be a little reluctant to get involved sometimes when the struggle involves mental illness. And it's actually a pretty large number. 2/3 are talking about, mention mental illness in sermons once a year or less.
Yeah.
Obviously, these are trained leaders.
Yeah, that's a hard question to pose, isn't it? What's going on here? What's the problem?
Because they're trained in dealing with spiritual issues, but a lot of the struggles that you're raising here are mental and relational needs.
They are.
How do we see a more continuity between those so that the pastor can still be helping spiritually, but also seeing how mental health and relational health fits in?
Sure. I mean, that to me is the ubiquitous question. I think in part, the short answer is we have had an artificial split in our culture and in our thinking and in our worldview between sacred and secular, or spiritual and psychological. And the truth is, as humans, we are integrated wholes. I think the longer answer is there are three, and I'm going to alliterate these, and this is a good 3-point sermon right here, folks, if you want to hatch this, to really help get this issue healthfully addressed in your congregation. I think, simply put, there are 3 responses. We've got to end the silence, we have to eliminate the shame, and we have to erase the stigma. So, in short, it's silence, shame, and stigma that have kept us from looking at and addressing mental and relational health issues in the church.
I think that's the start of a conversation right there, and hopefully one that we can encourage a lot of ministry leaders to have. Jared, this is Dr. Jared Pingleton. Thank you so much for joining us on Keep Asking. And again, the book that we've referred to a number of times is The Struggle is Real: How to Care for Mental and Relational Health Needs in the Church by Dr. Tim Clinton and Dr. Jared Pingleton, edited by them, but with a lot of other experts contributing to that resource. Thank you again for that resource, for continuing to serve the church and caregivers through the American Association of Christian Counselors, and for your partnership on some of the research we've been able to do on mental health.
Well, it's been a delight, Scott, and I appreciate your championing the cause and for you helping us get the issues out there and normalizing. I mean, you're helping end that silence, and you're helping to eliminate that shame and erase that stigma by virtue of the ministry and work you're doing. So my pleasure, and thank you very much for your part.
Thank you.
Clear.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time today, Jared. We will we'll get this edited and queued up here probably after the new year before we actually post it. But we'll let you know when it's up so we can kind of push it through social media. And
Wonderful.
Look forward to it.
Fantastic. Well, we appreciate that. And that timing will be great because hopefully right after the first of the year, we've been too busy to do a good job otherwise before the end of the year to get a media and publicity campaign going for the book and some of the resources we're wanting to kind of bundle and package around it. So that'll be perfect. I appreciate it. And oh my goodness, thanks for a wonderful interview. My goodness, you are gifted at that, sir.
Well, honestly, as I started going through the book, I was like this, I was expecting some clinical thing or something, and it was like, wow, this is really practical. So it kind of made it easy.
Yeah. Well, good. That was the goal. So I appreciate that. And again, that really is an outgrowth of the work that we did together back at Focus.
Yeah.
And that really was something they didn't have budget to continue, but Tim did. So this was something I just felt very passionate about, and I'm thrilled that we're getting the ball down the field.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. All right, we'll look forward to future opportunities to connect and work together.
Absolutely, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for that interview with Jared, and we want to thank our listeners for listening. If you have any questions for Scott about this interview or this project, tweet him at @SMcCon, and join us next time for another edition of Keep Asking. Keep asking, learn more, do better.